Accession number 23329, reel 14.
Kalyanga, reel 14.
Searches took place while we were on the parade ground, and as I think I've said before, we couldn't get back to the barracks, and classrooms were a very welcome refuge. They were on 25th of January 1944, there was a big search. Dixie Deans was low. He wasn't affected. His room was never searched. His humour recorded with the general prevailing mood. And when he saw Major Peschel, who was the head of security, he decided to bait him a little, and he said that he was very surprised that Major Peschel should choose this of all days for a search. And he said, I thought that you at least would respect a sacred day. Major Peschel wondered what this was about and asked, and Dixie told him it's Burns Day. Said it in tones of great reverence, said it was a day when all the Scots honoured their national poet, and it also happened to be his birthday. And Peschel was very contrite. He said, well, it was too late to call the search off, but certainly he would never have authorised it had he known. And he asked Dixie how he could recompense him in some way, and Dixie said, get me out of this place. And he thought no more about it. But an hour or so later, a German officer came to Dixie's room, and he said, Major Peschel's compliments, Sergeant Deans, I'm to take you for a walk. So Dixie managed to get two or three of his henchmen, like Ron Mogg and Cyril Ainsley, onto the walk as well, and off they went for a walk in the woods. In the theatre that evening, there was a great celebration of Burns Night. All the Scots in the cab turned up, and Dixie made a speech. Just before he went on, he was handed a mug of intoxicating liquor. I won't call it wine. I'm not sure what it was made from, probably potatoes. But anyway, it was liquid dynamite. And he made a very good speech, but afterwards had no recollection of it whatsoever. The Germans were having let us off at Christmas, had decided that they'd given us too much of a good thing, and so the search for liquor had been stepped up enormously, and there were a good many brews stowed away under the floorboards. We had one in D5, our hut, which used the old tunnel exit to conceal it. But everybody was preparing for the invasion. This was how it was going to be celebrated. However, our brew in D5 was discovered, and Dick, of course, as room leader, was present, and he invited some of the searchers to sample the brew, which they did. They liked it, and they had some more, quite unaware that it took a few minutes to act, but was then paralyzing. And when, let's say, they were out of action, Dick called up Canadian Jake Watson through the window, and people ran to get jugs, and Dick was handing the brew out through the window to everybody who wanted it. And at this time, Major Peschel arrived to see how his men were getting on with their search, and he went into a real foaming temper. The German officers often looked ridiculous. They almost foamed at the mouth, and they really seemed to cow their other ranks. But to us, they just seemed absurd. Anyway, he managed to galvanize his crew sufficiently, and they reeled to the gate. Major Peschel himself poured away what remained of the brew. However, this did create a diversion for Buck Buchanan. He had an escape plan, and he had hidden various articles, and in the plan also two other chaps from the hut, Quigley and Carpenter, were in on it too. Now, an engineer among the prisoners had put up a scheme to the Germans showing how the wastewater from the washrooms could be collected in a huge cistern and used to flush the latrines. They actually produced plans. They were studied by German engineers and approved. Work had begun. Now, for the convenience of their labourers, the Germans opened a gate in the, or put a gate in the fence behind the washroom, and it made an enclosure with a temporary fence around the washroom, and soon like a typical builder's yard. But the new fence was rather slack, and Buchanan's plan was to divert attention from himself and his companions and to slide under the wire. They would hide overnight in the yard, and in the morning they would disappear. However, the plan failed because everybody who turned out on the circuit to give some sort of cover, realised that the guards in the boxes were just too nonchalant, and they realised that they were at least suspicious, and possibly more than suspicious. Anyway, the attempt was abandoned, but it was used later on, and perhaps we'll come to that. But Buck was disappointed, but soon found another opportunity. More beds were being moved into the barracks to accommodate more prisoners, and that meant that the tall lockers that we had between the beds had to go. And they were very useful pieces of furniture, I must say. We missed them. Anyway, they were loaded up onto wagons, and there was just room for a man to stand in a locker. Buchanan, Quigley and Carpenter managed to bribe the driver of the wagon. They shut themselves in the lockers and they went undetected through the main gate. But then, whether he panicked or not, I don't know, but the driver signaled to a German officer outside, and the escapers were thwarted. They were sentenced to solitary confinement for 3 weeks. But then the new commandant, declaring his admiration for the attempt, which he said had been made in a brave and sporting manner without damage to Reich property, reduced the sentence to 1 week. It was almost a game in those days with almost agreed rules, and the commandant could afford to be magnanimous. He caught his men, and the incident seemed to show that the British prisoners still conformed to traditional methods of escape. There was another escape shortly after that, which is quite a nice little story. Jim Wilkie, a pilot who had taken Toby as his second pilot on Toby's last fateful flight, had already made an unsuccessful escape bid at the previous camp at Stalaglub 3, and he was ready to try again. So for months he cultivated a friendship, starting by feeding, of course, one of the dogs which prowled the compound at night. And he fed it titbits through the window while his handler was enjoying a cigarette somewhere else. And eventually the dog became very affectionate. So one night Wilkie jumped from the window. He had altered his RAF uniform sufficiently to pass a cursory inspection at night, and he walked out of the camp with the dog on a leash. He didn't need password or paper, just having the dog was a sufficient credential. However, he'd cultivated the dog too well, and it simply refused to leave him. So the dog that had guaranteed him an easy exit from the camp was now a burden. So he was soon caught and brought back to the camp, and even then the Alsatian despite being in disgrace, continued to follow Jim. In the spring of 1944, the life in the camp proceeded as normal. People played football, went to the theatre, went to debates, studied, and never realised that there were really dark goings on that they knew nothing of. In fact, I knew practically nothing about them until after the war, when Dixie gave me access to his papers. The Canary secret radio was hidden in a gramophone in Dixie's room, and two or three times was almost found, but it wasn't. It's difficult to cover really the escape activities because I was not involved in them in any way, but I'll add a little. Grimson, I mentioned earlier, had travelled on our train from Sagan and had got off somewhere in Poland. He was disguised then as a Gestapo man, and before he was caught, he had contacted the Polish resistance and in fact had established almost at that time an escape line. It was forbidden for the ordinary prisoner to engage in conversation with the Germans and particularly to attempt to trade with them. But the men from Tally Ho, as the escape organization was called, set up a deliberate campaign whereby they traded with using cigarettes, of which we had a great many, mostly from Canada, and the Germans had a very filthy kind of cigarette, so much could be purchased. It started off just with things like food or perhaps ink, which was forbidden. That was a curious thing. We were not allowed to have ink, but I had Indian ink, and drawings I actually sent out of the camp were censored, and nobody queried how I got the ink. But anyway, they stepped up the trading until they were in a position not to trade but to blackmail. Also sought out men from occupied countries such as Czechoslovakia and Poland who had signed up in the German army, and several of them didn't have to be bribed or blackmailed. They threw in their lot with Grimson. Collection of cigarettes was made periodically for the escape committee. It was an escape slush fund, but nothing seemed to happen, and people began to resent the imposition of a cigarette tax, if you like, and many thought Tally Ho was just a group who talked cloak and dagger, but didn't do anything about it. So it was thought that grumblers were something of a menace, and Tallyho decided on a very risky venture. They decided to show the prisoners how their money was being spent. And room leaders, including Dick, were invited to the library, and they found there, set out for their inspection, purchases of Tallyho. There were complete German uniforms, there were passes, ration cards, identification papers, everything that a German soldier would possess. They weren't forged, they were genuine. There were cameras, photographic equipment, tools, radio parts for transmitters as well as receivers, and civilian clothing. They had also bought knowledge. They were, had learned about all the regulations governing the movements of foreign workers, for example, the habits of servicemen on leave, the clubs and canteens which provided accommodation for German soldiers on leave. They learned about the rationing system, travel vouchers, even they knew the passwords for certain places. Needless to say, the room leaders were very impressed, and as they moved from table to table, suddenly the door crashed open and in came a German officer and a corporal. There was a shocked silence, and then there was relief because they recognised Morris and Grimson. Morris was the officer, Grimson the corporal. It was very dramatic, and it did remind the room that the exhibits weren't there just to impress them, they were to be used. Yes. Dick came back to the barrack trembling, and he called for silence, and with lookouts posted, he briefly described what he had seen. The same went on as camp leaders briefed the members of their barracks, so that in the end, everybody knew what was going on, and the grumbling stopped. But it was still very risky because talk could be overheard, and there were some very clever men, including Gestapo, among the guards, and I won't go into Grimson's activities. They're well documented in Aidan Crawley's official account in Escape from Germany. But briefly, Grimson left the camp in German uniform with correct papers and giving the correct password. He travelled to Danzig and booked into a hotel, and linked up with the underground movement, organised a courier system, and himself travelled widely. He even came back to the camp on occasion, and he arranged for delicacies to like strawberries to go to men in sick bay. Three men, Flockhart, Lewis and Callender, left the camp at intervals up to the middle of March. They were all properly equipped, and their absence and Grimson's was covered up. Roll calls were held in Hollow Square formation, and usually it was possible to smuggle men across the joint, if that's the right word, the corner. And so men who'd been counted were slipped over, the guards being their attention being diverted in some way or another. Now, there was also a count in the barracks at night, and what happened, nobody was as crude as putting dummies in the beds. There were very well concealed trapdoors between some of the rooms, so that men counted in one could slip through and be counted again. And it was only the system was almost blown when a German officer fluked a discovery of one trapdoor during a room search. He looked at the room leader, who of course was present, and he was met with an audacious wink, and as the room leader intended, immediately assumed that the trapdoor was being used by gays to visit friends during the night. And perhaps he was unduly sympathetic. Anyway, he closed the door, remarked on its cunning, and never made any report. Jack Gilbert, who was a Pole, that wasn't his real name, but it was the name he used, and another man, Townsend Coles, went early in April, and then on the 19th of April, the plan that Buchanan had for escape was used by Nat Lehman. He spent the night in the washhouse, mingled with the workmen in the morning, and made his bid to get away. Unhappily, he was recognized by a German, and he was caught in civilian clothes with things on his person that authorities had never dreamed prisoners of war could ever have obtained. Dixie said he was absolutely loaded. And the Germans knew then that they'd stumbled on something pretty big. We were assembled for morning appel, and Hancock, who was standing in for Dixie, walked quickly around the ranks and warned that the balloon's going up. It was a long roll call. The Germans were in an ugly temper, and later in the morning another parade was called, and this time they had a job to winkle everybody out, and this was infuriating as far as the Germans were concerned. This time it was a sheep count, and dragged far into the afternoon. The sheep count I think I've described before. There was a lot of antagonism between prisoners and guards, and some of the guards took swings with their rifle butts, usually provoked, it has to be said. And then at 5 o'clock another special assembly was called, and we realised that the guards had been reinforced. In fact, hundreds of German soldiers, mostly I think, came in bringing machine guns and submachine guns, and we decided that this was no time for playing about. Remember that the ordinary prisoner knew little or nothing of what was going on, but they began to sense that there was something extraordinary. We all gathered in our usual hollow square position and watched very closely by, it seemed, an endless line of guards. And then the adjutant, who was Major Heinrich, stalked to the centre of the parade ground with a camp interpreter, and Dixie followed, marching formally, but out of step with the Germans, which was quite deliberate, dissociating himself with them.